We're going to continue now with the next section of tonight's installment of Radio Free America number 37, How the United States Lost the Second World War. Now recall that what we've looked at so far was the plans of the German industrialists to formally effect a break from Hitler and to resume contact, although as we've seen, contact between these German industrialists and financiers and their American and British counterparts, that contact was never really broken, but they plan to resume, to use the international cartel connections, actually that's redundant, the cartel connections, to help to preserve their interests after the Second World War to, in essence, establish a post-Hitler Reich. And we've taken a look at how Alan Dulles, a key American member of the transatlantic industrial and financial axis, as the Baron Switzerland representative of OSS, was in touch with other members of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis. These were Germans, or in some cases German-Americans. The main name is Gero von Gebernitz. How many of these people were in Switzerland in touch with Dulles as representatives of the Canaris Group, and how ultimately the negotiations between the Canaris Group and Alan Dulles and the Christian West concept, which they were working on to establish a coup against Hitler and establish Anglo-American-German military cooperation and to hold the front against the Soviet Union. Ultimately, these negotiations led to negotiations between Max von Hohenlohe, Prince von Hohenlohe, a representative of the SS, being dispatched by Walter Schellenberg, head of Amt 6, of the Sicherheitsdienst, and how the Christian West concept was then formalized between von Hohenlohe as representative of the SS and Alan Dulles as representative of American corporate interests and, quote, Roosevelt's personal representative. What we're going to be looking at now is the formation of the Galen Organization. Again, the main names to remember, in addition to von Hohenlohe, are Gero von Gebernitz, who was working with Dulles as a member of the Canaris Group, channeling information, espionage information, to the British and Americans, but also, as we've seen, functioning as a triple agent and channeling information back to the Third Reich. Gero von Gebernitz is a name we're going to come back to later. Also remember the name Hans Bernd Gisevius, who was one of the Canaris people in touch with Dulles through von Gebernitz on behalf of Canaris. Also, as we have seen, though, he retained his rank in the SS, another individual who was central to these negotiations. And as we've seen, even though there was never a successful plot against Adolf Hitler, the Christian West concept is basically the seed concept for NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. What we're going to look at now is how the Reinhard Galen Organization, the Nazi Eastern Front spy outfit, came to be at the center of NATO, its pivotal influence in both the United States and Germany, and the influence it wielded on NATO and the Cold War. We're specifically going to look at how the Galen Organization influenced the United States next week. We're going to begin looking at the Galen Organization now and how at the center of the Christian West concept was a most un-Christian organization, because the Galen Organization, as we shall see to a large extent, represented a wing of the Odessa, the post-World War II SS underground. There were thousands of very important SS and Gestapo people in the Galen Organization, and it should be recalled, as we've looked at in other broadcasts in the past, at the core of the SS philosophy was an occult, a pan-German occult philosophy, which was anything but Christian. Certainly their behavior, as recorded by history, was anything but Christian. It should be recalled, though, that at the core of the SS philosophy was an occultism which was deeply alien to the fundamentals of Christianity. By the way, I'm not a practicing Christian. Recall that one of the things that we've looked at in the past was that the SS Oath of Allegiance was a passage from Goethe which translated was the Lord's Prayer backwards. That is a so-called black mass. What we're going to be looking at now, again, is the Galen Organization, how it began to function, or at least in the view of Carl Oglesby, and it's a view I subscribe to, how it began to function as a wing of the Odessa. And as we shall see, the Galen Organization literally functioned as a Trojan horse inside of the United States. It should be recalled that one of the statements, and I'll touch on this again in the future, one of the key statements in Kurt Rees's The Nazis Go Underground was that the exact nature of the post-World War II Nazi underground would be determined by political conditions at the time. The advent of nuclear weapons basically precluded the possibility of overt, broad frontal warfare of the kind that we saw in the World Wars, with the threat of mutually assured destruction. It was no longer possible to send whole army groups crashing across an enemy's border. So the function of espionage and covert action in the nuclear age has been greatly magnified. What has been known, what has come to be known as low-intensity warfare or covert operation, replaced broad frontal warfare as the main vehicle for international conflict. And as we have seen in other archives in the past, notably Radio Free America shows 1, 2, and 3, dealing with the Galen Organization, programs 14 and 15, and Radio Free America program number 36. Also, Radio Free America 22 dealt extensively with Galen. Radio Free America program number 36, the destabilization of the USSR in Eastern Europe, also featured the Galen Organization and related elements prominently. But we're going to take a look at now is the Galen Organization and how it came to be at the apex of the, quote, Christian West, unquote, concept, which was formulated by both German and American and British representatives of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis that we're looking at. Again, the Christian West concept was the seed concept for NATO. What we're going to look at now is an article from Covert Action Information Bulletins, issue number 35 from the fall of 1990. This article is called Reinhard Galen, The Secret Treaty of Fort Hunt. It's by author Carl Oglesby, last name O-G-L-E-S-B-Y. By the way, I would strongly recommend that people subscribe to Covert Action Information Bulletin. It's a quarterly and is the best periodical about the functioning of the U.S. intelligence apparatus. Also, you can order back issues from Covert Action. The address is Covert Action Information Bulletin, 1500 Massachusetts Avenue, Northwest, number 732. That's in Washington, D.C., 20005. Once again, Covert Action Information Bulletin, 1500 Massachusetts Avenue, Northwest, number 732. That's in Washington, D.C., 20005. And you can, in addition to subscribing, as I said, you can also order back issues of CAIB. We're going to proceed now with a reading and analysis of Oglesby's article. Oglesby begins, William Shirer closed his 1960 masterpiece, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, with the judgment that the Nazi regime, quote, had passed into history, unquote. But we cannot be so confident today. On the contrary, the evidence as of 1990 is that World War II did not end as Shirer believed it did, that Nazism did not surrender unconditionally and disappear, that indeed it finessed a limited but crucial victory over the Allies, a victory no less significant for having been kept a secret from all but the few Americans who were directly involved. The next section of Oglesby's article after the introduction is called The Odessa and Its Mission. Hitler continued to rant of victory, but after Germany's massive defeat in the Battle of Stalingrad in mid-January of 1943, the realists of the German General Staff, OKW, were all agreed that their game was lost. Defeat at Stalingrad meant at a minimum that Germany could not win the war in the East that year. This, in turn, meant that the Nazis would have to keep the great preponderance of their military forces tied down on the Eastern Front and could not redeploy them to the West, where the Anglo-American invasion of Italy would occur that summer. Apparently inspired by the Soviet victory, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Prime Minister Winston Churchill announced at Casablanca on January 24, 1943, their demand for Germany's unconditional surrender and the complete denazification of Europe. Within the German General Staff, two competing groups formed around the question of what to do, one led by Heinrich Himmler, the other by Martin Bormann. Himmler was chief of the SS, the Schutzstaffel, or protective echelon, the black-shirted core of the Nazi Party that emerged as Hitler's bodyguard in the late 1920s and grew into the most powerful of the Nazi political institutions. After the failure of the attempted military coup of July 20, 1944, which wounded but did not kill Hitler, the SS seized all power and imposed a furious blood purge of the armed services, in which some 7,000 were arrested and nearly 5,000 executed. The SS was at that point the only organ of the Nazi state. Himmler's plan for dealing with the grim situation facing Nazism found its premise in Hitler's belief that the alliance between, quote, the ultra-capitalists, unquote, of the U.S. and, quote, the ultra-Marxists, unquote, of the Soviet Union was politically unstable. Quote, "Even now they are at loggerheads," unquote, said Hitler, again quoting, "If we can now deliver a few more blows, this artificially bolstered common front may suddenly collapse with a giant clap of thunder," unquote. Himmler believed that this collapse would occur and that the U.S. would then consider the formation of a new anti-Soviet alliance with Nazi Germany. The Nazis would then negotiate, quote, a separate peace, unquote, with the United States, separate from any peace with the USSR, with which Germany would remain at war, now joined against the Soviets by the United States. But Martin Bormann, who was even more powerful than Himmler, did not accept the premise of the separate peace idea. Bormann was an intimate of Hitler's, the deputy Führer and head of the Nazi Party, thus superior to Himmler in rank. Bormann wielded additional power as Hitler's link to the industrial and financial cartels that ran the Nazi economy, and was particularly close to Hermann Schmitz, chief executive of IG Farben, the giant chemical firm that was Nazi Germany's greatest industrial power. With the support of Schmitz, Bormann rejected Himmler's separate peace strategy on the ground that it was far too optimistic. The Allied military advantage was too great, Bormann believed, for Roosevelt to be talked into a separate peace. Roosevelt, after all, had taken the lead in proclaiming the Allies' demand for Germany's unconditional surrender and total denazification. Bormann reasoned rather that the Nazis' best hope of surviving military defeat lay within their own resources, chief of which was the cohesion of tens of thousands of SS men for whom the prospect of surrender could offer only the gallows. Bormann and Schmitz developed a more aggressive, self-contained approach to the problem of the looming military defeat, the central concept of which was that large numbers of Nazis would have to leave Europe and at least for a time find places in the world in which to recover their strength. There were several possibilities in Latin America, most notably Argentina and Paraguay, South Africa, Egypt, and Indonesia were also attractive areas in which to retreat, attractive rear areas in which to retreat. After the German defeat in the Battle of Normandy in June of 1944, Bormann took the first external steps toward implementing concrete plans for the Nazis' great escape. An enormous amount of Nazi treasure had to be moved out of Europe and made safe. This treasure was apparently divided into several cachets, of which the one at the Reichsbank in Berlin included almost 3 tons of gold, much of it the so-called tooth gold from the slaughter camps, as well as silver, platinum, tens of thousands of carats of precious stones, and perhaps $1 billion in various currencies. There were industrial assets to be expatriated, including large tonnages of specialty steel and certain industrial machinery, as well as blueprints critical to the domination of certain areas of manufacturing. Key Nazi companies needed to be relicensed outside Germany in order to escape the reach of war reparations claims, and tens of thousands of Nazi war criminals, almost all of them members of the SS, needed help to escape Germany and safely regroup in foreign colonies capable of providing security and livelihoods. For help with the first three of these tasks, Bormann convened a secret meeting of key German industrialists on August 10, 1944, at the Hotel Maison Rouge in Strasbourg. One part of the minutes of this meeting states, quote, "The Nazi Party is ready to supply large amounts of money to these industrialists who contribute to the post-war organization abroad. In return, the party demands all financial reserves which have already been transferred abroad or may later be transferred so that after the defeat, a strong new Reich can be built." The Nazi expert in this area was Hitler's one-time financial genius and Minister of the Economy, Dr. Hjalmar Horace Greeley Schacht, available to Bormann even though he was in prison on suspicion of involvement in the anti-Hitler coup of 1944. According to a U.S. Treasury Department report of 1945, at least 750 enterprises financed by the Nazi Party had been set up outside Germany by the end of the war. These firms were capable of generating an annual income of approximately $30 million, all of it available to Nazi causes. It was Schacht's ability to finesse the legalities of licensing and ownership that brought the situation about. Organizing the physical removal of the Nazis' material assets and the escape of SS personnel were the tasks of the hulking Otto Skorzeny, S-K-O-R-Z-E-N-Y, simultaneously an officer of the SS, the Gestapo, and the Waffen-SS, as well as Hitler's favorite commando. Skorzeny worked closely with Bormann and Schacht in transporting the Nazi assets to safety outside Europe and in creating a network of SS escape routes, or rat lines, that led from all over Germany to the Bavarian city of Memmingen, then to Rome, then by sea to a number of Nazi retreat colonies set up in the global south. The international organization created to accommodate Bormann's plans is most often called the Odessa, a German acronym for, quote, Organization of Veterans of the SS, unquote. It has remained active as a shadowy presence since the war and may indeed constitute Nazism's most notable organizational achievement. But we must understand that none of Bormann's, Skorzeny's, and Schacht's well-laid plans would have stood the least chance of succeeding had it not been for a final component of their organization, one not usually associated with the Odessa at all, but very possibly the linchpin of the entire project. Let's pause to take a look at what we've seen so far in this section. First of all, again, Oglesby makes the point, and I think it is a valid one, that Germany finessed a limited victory over the United States, and we're going to come to see how that happened in weeks to come. We've already taken a look at the pivotal role of Galen and Galen-related elements in the assassination of John Kennedy, functioning as part of an explicitly fascist milieu in cooperation with the American far right, such as elements of the John Birch Society associated with the Hunt family. We have also taken a look at the intersection between this milieu and the U.S. intelligence apparatus, and we will also take a look at how the broader aspects of this particular milieu as well, and bear in mind that this milieu is directly connected to mainstream American politics. George Bush is part and parcel to this particular milieu. Now, bear in mind again that the Third Reich had long envisioned its military victory well before 1944 or 1945. As we've looked at earlier, the German generals were planning to make provisions for defeat from 1941 on, the Nazi Party proper from 1943 on. Now, note too that there were two distinct approaches, at least as analyzed by Oglesby here, to how to conduct the going underground of the Nazi Party. Bear in mind that Himmler favored Hitler's separate peace proposal. That did not happen during the course of the military war, but as we've seen, the Christian West concept was essentially what Hitler and Himmler were aiming at in that particular attitude toward defeat and towards resurgence of the Reich. As we've seen, the Christian West concept was one which was central to the transatlantic industrial and financial axis that we've been looking at and that we've looked at for so many years here on this program, and that the Christian West concept was the seed concept for NATO. I would also note the Martin Bormann approach, which involved the forging together of German industrialists and financiers, those involved around the cartels, which also obviously involved large elements of American industry and finance, and the fusing together of these industrialists and financiers and the Nazi Party to finance Nazi activities abroad. Obviously, the transatlantic financial and industrial axis that we've spoken about was part and parcel to the German financial cartels, and the fusing together of German industry and finance with the Nazi Party, and that happened, obviously placed Nazism per se directly into this milieu, the German Nazi Party per se. Obviously, this milieu had been, this transatlantic financial and industrial axis had been deeply involved with helping it to arm and finance the Third Reich. Many of its participants, such as Alan Dulles, were also basically of pro-Axis sympathies. And again, we're not going to go into the Latin American operations of the post-World War II Nazi underground later on, and as I update some current stories, we're going to get to touch on that. But do take note of the fact, and this is well documented, that a U.S. Treasury Department report said that there were more than 750 companies that were formed by the Nazi Party and operating abroad. This is something that has never been properly accounted for, and unfortunately it's something that's very much with us today. Continuing now with the next section of Oglesby's article, entitled Enter Galen, it begins, "This final element of the Odessa was the so-called Galen organization, the ORG, the Nazi intelligence system that sold itself to the U.S. at the end of the war. It was by far the most audacious, most critical, and most essential part of the entire Odessa undertaking. The literature on the Odessa and that on the Galen organization, however, are two different things. No writer in the field of Nazi studies has yet explicitly associated the two, despite the fact that General Reinhard Galen was tied politically, as well as personally, with Skorzeny and Schacht. Moreover, Galen's fabled post-war organization was in large part staffed by SS Nazis who are positively identified with the Odessa, men such as the infamous Franz Alfred Sieks and Emil Augsburg of the Wannsee Institute." Wannsee's W-A-N-N-S-E-E, Sieks and Augsburg were discussed in Radio Free America number 2 at considerable length. By the way, I would also note that in Radio Free America number 3, which I did in June of 1984, I made the equation of the Galen organization with the Odessa. That's the same basic thesis that 6 years later Carl Oglesby is presenting, and I'm reading it to you 2 years after he presented it. But those of you who are interested can get a hold of the archives, and specifically Radio Free America number 3 from June of 1984. I made this equation at this time. Continuing. "An even more compelling reason for associating Galen with the Odessa is that without his organization as a screen, the various Odessa projects would have been directly exposed to American intelligence. If the Counterintelligence Corps, or CIC, and the Office of Strategic Services, or OSS, had not been neutralized by the Galen ploy, the Odessa's great escape scheme would have been discovered and broken up. At 43, Brigadier General Reinhard Galen was a stiff, unpossessing man of 5'8.5" and 128 pounds when he presented himself for surrender at the U.S. Command Center at Fischhausen. That's Fischhausen. But there was nothing small about his ego. Quote, "I am head of the section Foreign Armies East in German Army Headquarters," unquote, he announced to the GI at the desk. Again quoting, "I have information to give of the highest importance to your government," unquote. The GI was not impressed, however, and Galen spent weeks stewing in a POW compound before an evident Soviet eagerness to find him finally aroused the Americans' attention. Galen became chief of the Third Reich's Foreign Armies East, or FHO, on April 1, 1942. He was thus responsible for Germany's military intelligence operations throughout East Europe and the Soviet Union. His FHO was connected in this role with a number of secret fascist organizations in the countries to Germany's east. These included Stepan Bandera's B faction of the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, OUNB, Romania's Iron Guard, the Ustashi of Yugoslavia, the Vanagis, V-A-N-A-G-I-S of Latvia, and after the summer of 1942, Vlasov's Army, the band of defectors from Soviet communism marching behind former Red Hero General Andrei Vlasov. Later on in the war, Galen placed one of his top men in control of Foreign Armies West, which broadened his power, and then after Admiral Wilhelm Canaris was purged and his Abwehr intelligence service cannibalized by the SS, Galen became, in effect, Nazi Germany's overall top intelligence official. I'm going to pause at this particular point, and I'm going to read you a couple of sections, actually, from a book about Galen that we dealt with in our first two Radio Free America shows. This is called The General Was a Spy, subtitled The Truth About General Galen and His Spy Ring. It's co-authored by Heinz Hühne and Hermann Zolling. Hühne is H-O-U-M-L-A-U-T H-N-E. Hermann Zolling is Z-O-L-L-I-N-G. It's published in hardcover by Coward, McCann, and Goffin, Incorporated. It's G-E-O-G-H-E-G-A-N, and it's copyrighted 1971. Now, what we're going to look at here is the close collaboration between Reinhard Galen and the RSHA, the Central Bureau of the SS that I spoke about earlier, and in particular, take note not only of Galen's close connection to the RSHA, but his connections with the aforementioned Walter Schellenberg, head of Amt 6, of the Sicherheitsdienst. Basically, that was the international affairs section of the SS intelligence service. It was Schellenberg who was aware of the, quote, resistance people grouped around the German industrialists, some of whom were dispatched by Canaris to deal with Alan Dulles, and recall that the SS and other Nazi functionaries were aware of the plotting against Hitler. They let it go on because it was deemed to be politically useful. And ultimately, the Canaris links to Alan Dulles that were established by people like Gero von Gebernitz and others, including Hans Bernd Gisibius, who himself retained rank in the SS, ultimately, those contacts between Canaris people and Alan Dulles led to the connection that led to the contact between Prince Max von Hohenlohe and Alan Dulles, and von Hohenlohe, dispatched by Schellenberg, was specifically an emissary of the SS, and recall that's where more of the Christian West concept was hammered out. And as we've seen again, the Christian West concept formed by members of this transatlantic industrial and financial axis involved with both Allied and Third Reich intelligence during the war was the basic seed concept out of which NATO grew. But here, take note, in The General Was a Spy, of the close links between Schellenberg and the RSHA and Galen. Reading now from The General Was a Spy, Hune and Zoling write, Galen succeeded in establishing even closer links with Hermann Bonn and Schmalschlager, that's S-C-H-M-A-L-S-C-H-L-A-U-M-L-A-G-E-R. Schellenberg raised no objection to Wally Vaughn and three remaining entirely subordinate to FHO, quote, from the military point of view, unquote. FHO is Fremdeherre Ost, or Foreign Armies East. Continuing, they retained their old titles until the very end of the war, and the SS designations never became the rule. In fact, the RSHA was only too happy to let Galen go his own way, for even the SD recognized the value of FHO's work. Colonel Galen became an increasingly close and indispensable partner of the RSHA. What is the explanation of this mystery? The defenders of Galen prefer to leave it unexplained, for close collaboration between RSHA and FHO stands in glaring contrast to the picture which his admirers like to draw of the role he played in the final phase of the Third Reich. The first president of the BND likes to present himself as a resistance fighter, or at least as opposed to the Nazi state. That, of course, is absolute poppycock. We've looked at that in the past. Going back to The General Was a Spy, more about the contact between the RSHA and the FHO under Galen, and bear in mind that Walter Schellenberg was deeply involved with Reinhard Galen. Cooperation between FHO and the RSHA became increasingly close, and relations between Galen and the SD officers increasingly intimate. Consultation with FHO on their manifold subversive activities became a matter of routine to the SD. Whether they wanted information on Soviet partisans, investigations into adherents of the Free Germany Committee formed by German prisoners of war in the Soviet Union, or evaluation of intelligence received by the SD from foreign intelligence services, the FHO was always on hand to enlighten its SS comrades. FHO's information was in fact so useful that the RSHA gave almost ungrudging recognition to the work of Galen's section. When he visited FHO headquarters, Schellenberg flattered his host Galen, saying that the SD would never be able to work with the scientific precision of FHO. And still later, Galen ultimately became so close an ally of the RSHA that during the death throes of Adolf Hitler's regime, he, together with the SS officers Skorzeny and Klutzmann, was charged with military direction of that macabre partisan and resistance organization known as, quote, werewolf, unquote, intended to spread panic among the enemy. Prutzmann, by the way, P-R-U-U-M-L-A-U-T, T-Z-M-A-N-N. So again, Galen was very close to RSHA and Walter Schellenberg, and it was Schellenberg who dispatched Prince von Hohenlohe on behalf of the SS to negotiate with Alan Dulles. The Christian West concept was further developed after that. And bear in mind that as we looked at last week in The Nazis Go Underground, it was the SS and the Gestapo that were to form the core of the post-World War II Nazi underground. Continuing now with Carl Oglesby's article from Covert Action Information Bulletin, number 35 in the fall of 1990. Now bear in mind, too, one of the concepts I introduced last week, and that was one of the main theoretical and operational considerations of the Third Reich, both when it was a nascent political movement in Weimar Germany, and when it became the dominant world power that it did, and after it was supposedly dissolved, really the word is eclipsed here, at the end of the formal conclusion to World War II, bear in mind that at the German General Staff, the Nazi Party, and also the industrialists and financiers allied with them, learned to use anti-communism, the fear of communism, as a major strategic tool for their own aims of conquest and preservation. That's central to the entire thesis of Radio Free America 37. Now we're going to return to Carl Oglesby's article. In December of 1943, at the latest, Galen reached the same conclusion about the war that had come upon Bormann, Schacht, Skorzeny, and Himmler. Germany was losing and could do nothing about it. Several months later, Galen says, he began quietly discussing the impending defeat with a few close associates. As he writes in his memoir, quote, "Early in October of 1944, I told my more intimate colleagues that I considered the war was lost and we must begin thinking of the future. We had to think ahead and plan for the approaching catastrophe." Galen's strategic response to Götterdämmerung was a kind of fusion of Himmler's philosophy with Bormann's more pessimistic Odessa line. Quote, "My view," he writes, "was that there would be a place even for Germany in a Europe rearmed for defense against communism. Therefore, we must set our sights on the Western powers and give ourselves two objectives: to help defend against communist expansion and to recover and reunify Germany's lost territories." And again, Galen's view here basically is a synthesis of the Bormann and Himmler views, and basically represents the Christian West concept, which we're focusing on this evening. That Galen's conclusions, again, "My view," he writes, "was that there would be a place even for Germany in a Europe rearmed for defense against communism. Therefore, we must set our sights on the Western powers and give ourselves two objectives: to help defend against communist expansion and to recover and reunify Germany's lost territories." Just as Bormann, Skorzeny, and Schacht were beginning to execute their escape plans, so too was Galen. Quote, "Setting his sights on the Western powers," unquote, and in particular on the United States, Galen pursued the following strategic rationale. When the alliance between the United States and the USSR collapsed, as it was bound to do upon Germany's defeat, the United States would discover a piercing need for a top-quality intelligence service in Eastern Europe and inside the Soviet Union. It did not have such a service of its own, and the pressures of the erupting East-West conflict would not give it time to develop one from scratch. Let the United States, therefore, leave the assets assembled by Galen and the FHO intact. Let the United States not break up Galen's relationship with East European fascist groups. Let the United States pick up Galen's organization and put it to work for the West, the better to prevail in its coming struggle against the Soviet Union, soon to become its ex-ally. Galen brought his top staff people into the planning for this amazing proposal. Together, during the last months of the war, while Hitler was first raging at Galen for his, quote, defeatist, unquote, intelligence reports, then promoting him to the rank of brigadier general, then at last firing him altogether, but promoting into the FHO directorship one of Galen's co-conspirators, Galen and his staff carefully prepared their huge files on East Europe and the Soviet Union and moved them south into the Bavarian Alps and buried them. At the same time, Galen began building the ranks of the FHO intelligence agents. The FHO, in fact, was the only organization in the whole of the Third Reich that was actually recruiting new members as the war was winding down. SS men who knew they would be in trouble when the Allied forces arrived now came flocking to the FHO, knowing that it was the most secure place for them to be when the war finally ended. When Galen's plans were complete and his preparations all concluded, he divided his top staff into three separate groups and moved them, as Skorzeny was doing at the same time, into prearranged positions in Bavaria. Galen himself was in place before the German surrender on May 7th, hiding comfortably in a well-stocked chalet in a mountain lee called Misery Meadow. Besides Galen, there were eight others in the Misery Meadow group, including two wounded men and three young women. For 3 weeks, maintaining radio contact with the two other groups, Galen and his colleagues stayed on the mountain, waiting for the American army to appear in the valley far below. Quote, "These days of living in the arms of nature were truly enchanting," unquote, he wrote. Quote, "We had grown accustomed to the peace, and our ears were attuned to nature's every sound," unquote. That's very touching. Let's pause here to take a look at what Oglesby has talked about in this last section of his article. Again, note that one of the key elements of the Gehlen organization, both when it was the Hitler organization in World War II and later when it jumped to U.S. intelligence, among the key components were the OUN B group of Stefan Bandera. We took a look at Bandera in the first two Radio Free America shows, in Radio Free America shows 14 and 15. And we also took a look at it in a big way in Radio Free America 36. We came back to the Bandera organization and the connections between the assassination of Stefan Bandera and the assassination of John Kennedy. The assassination of the former, allegedly at the hands of the KGB, was used by elements grouped around the World Anti-Communist Congress for Freedom and Liberation, the seed group of the World Anti-Communist League, to help portray the picture of Lee Harvey Oswald as a communist assassin. The fear that that would provoke a Third World War was one of the things which helped to persuade many people who knew otherwise to cover up the assassination and pin the assassination of JFK on Lee Harvey Oswald, the lone nut. And note again that Gehlen's approach was a synthesis of the Hitler and Himmler approaches, and basically Gehlen's approach was absolutely consistent, that is, his approach to defeat was absolutely consistent with the Christian West concept, which, as we've seen, it was a concept which gave rise directly to the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. It was one that was hammered out during the World War II. The basic outlines for it were hammered out during World War II, not NATO proper, but the concept which obviously from which NATO grew was hammered out during World War II by German and American representatives of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis, explicitly fascist in character. And both the German and American industrialists and financiers were serving as functionaries of their respective intelligence apparatus. And it's also worth noting, again, that as Oglesby points out, Fremde Heere Ost was one of the very few organizations, which was Third Reich organizations, which was still being built as World War II was drawing to a close. And note again, as we've noted in the first three Radio Free America shows, that many SS and Gestapo veterans jumped to the Gehlen organization, and in turn this paved the way for many SS and Gestapo people to move up into the U.S. intelligence system. We're going to proceed now with the next section of Carl Oglesby's article. Gehlen was still communing with nature when William Donovan, chief of the Office of Strategic Services, arrived in Nuremberg from Washington, dispatched by the new president to assist Supreme Court Justice Robert Jackson. Harry S. Truman had made Jackson the United States Chief Prosecutor with the International Military Tribunal, or IMT, established to try the Nazis' principal military leaders. Donovan's OSS was to function as an investigative arm of the IMT. By the last half of the war, if not before, President Roosevelt and Donovan were convinced that the U.S. needed a permanent intelligence service, and that this service, like the OSS, should be civilian rather than military. They were convinced, too, that the OSS should be its foundation. On October 31, 1944, Roosevelt directed Donovan to prepare a memo on how such a service should be organized. Donovan consulted on this assignment with his colleague Alan Dulles, a force unto himself as wartime chief of OSS operations in Bern. Dulles advised Donovan to placate the military by proposing that the new agency be placed automatically under military command in time of war. Donovan's proposal incorporated this idea, but only in order to state all the more strongly the case for civilian control and for making the OSS the basis of the new organization. As he wrote in his memo to Roosevelt of November 18, 1944, quote, "There are common sense reasons why you may desire to lay the keel of the ship at once. We have now in the OSS the trained and specialized personnel needed for such a task, and this talent should not be dispersed." Donovan proposed establishment of a civilian intelligence service responsible directly to the President and the Secretary of State, the chief mission of which would be to support the President in foreign policy. Except for the civilian secretaries of war and the Navy, Donovan's plan did not even include a place for military representation on the advisory board, and he was careful to specify that the advisory board would merely advise and not control. The new service was to be all-powerful in its field, being responsible for, quote, "coordination of the functions of all intelligence agencies of the government," unquote. The Donovan Intelligence Service, in other words, would directly and explicitly dominate the Army's G2 and the Navy's ONI. Naturally, therefore, the Donovan plan drew an intense attack from the military. One G2 officer called it, quote, cumbersome and possibly dangerous, unquote. Another referred to the OSS as, quote, a bunch of faggots, unquote. Nor was the FBI's J. Edgar Hoover silent. Hoover had fought creation of the OSS perhaps more bitterly than the military, and had insisted throughout the war on maintaining an FBI intelligence network in Latin America, despite the fact that this was supposed to be OSS turf. Certain elements within Army intelligence were not only opposed to Donovan's plan, but were also beginning to formulate their own notions of what a post-war intelligence system should be like. Roosevelt sent the Joint Chiefs of Staff ultra-secret copies of Donovan's proposal, along with Roosevelt's own draft executive order to implement it. On January 1, 1945, the chiefs formally reported to Roosevelt their extreme dissatisfaction with this scheme and leaked Donovan's memo to four right-wing newspapers, which leapt to the attack with blaring headlines accusing FDR and Donovan of conspiring to create a super Gestapo, unquote. This attack put the Donovan plan on hold, and the death of FDR on April 12, 1945, destroyed it. By the way, one factor I'm not going to discuss in this entire scenario, there are questions about the death of President Roosevelt, chiefly the fact that the Nazis, who, as I've mentioned, had the inner core of Nazism was built around an occult religious philosophy, and some of the Nazi leadership were into astrology, and the astrological forecasters for Adolf Hitler had forecast April 13th, 1945, as the day on which Nazi fortunes would change. Roosevelt died on April 12th, 1945. It was that date in the United States, but it was April 13th in Europe, because they're, I think, about 10 hours ahead of us, maybe 12. But in any event, it was April 13th in Europe. I am not a believer in astrology, and that in combination with a number of other things have led me to question whether Roosevelt's death was actually natural. We will never know, and at this point it doesn't make a whole lot of difference. But it should be noted that Roosevelt, at the time that he died, was having his picture painted by a white Russian named Elizabeth Shumatov, who, along with another white Russian who had accompanied her, had engaged in a discussion with Roosevelt shortly before he died. The other white Russian there, when Roosevelt was talking about the enormous destruction that he had witnessed at Yalta from World War II, or Roosevelt had just come back, the other white Russian commented that it had obviously been the Bolsheviks, it had probably been the Bolsheviks and not the Nazis, who wreaked this destruction, which caused Roosevelt to raise his eyebrows. Roosevelt died shortly after that, and the aforementioned Shumatov and her companion, who said that the destruction at Yalta had probably been done by the Bolsheviks and not the Nazis, didn't even stop to find out how Roosevelt was. They climbed in their car and drove lickety-split through a driving rainstorm, and they didn't even hear that Roosevelt had died until they heard the news on the radio while driving away. 2 weeks later, Roosevelt's medical records disappeared from Bethesda Naval Hospital. Now, we cannot draw a conclusion from that, but it does raise some questions about Roosevelt's death. In particular, the Nazis forecast that as the day on which their fortunes would change. It's questionable whether Roosevelt would have permitted such a deal, that is, such a Galen organization deal, and the appeasement of the Third Reich, which took place, and with the white Russian component so deeply involved in the Galen organization, as we've seen, white Russians were deeply involved in the assassination of John Kennedy many years later, and with the curious behavior of Shumatov and her and companion, and with the disappearance of Roosevelt's medical records from Bethesda Naval Hospital 2 weeks after his death, it does raise some questions. I would also note that one of Roosevelt's sons has publicly expressed his belief that FDR was murdered. But in any event, we will never know for sure. At this distance in time, it really doesn't make a whole lot of difference, but it is a curious minor detail to ponder. Continuing now with Oglesby's article. In early May of 1945, president for less than a month, Truman made the OSS the American component of the investigative arm of the IMT. It is one of the fascinating conjunctions of this story that Donovan should have left for Nuremberg just as Galen was coming down from his mountain. It is one of its riper ironies that Donovan would soon resign from Jackson's staff in a disagreement over trying German officers as war criminals, which Donovan objected to but Jackson and Truman supported. Had Donovan lent his energies to the trial of Nazis within the German officer corps, he might have confronted the very adversaries who would shortly take his place in the American intelligence system, not only militarizing it, but Nazifying it as well. Now, with regard to the destruction of the OSS, one of the things we're going to look at next week is the role of a military intelligence official named John Frenchy Grombach, G-R-O-M-B-A-C-H, and his role in destroying the OSS's Research and Analysis Division. Grombach is a key name in the resumption of the program that we're going to engage in next week. And it's also ironic that William Donovan resigned because of his disagreement at trying Nazi officer, German officers as war criminals. We should note, obviously, that many of these officers were war criminals, and an awful lot of them, as noted here by Oglesby, jumped to the Galen organization. Also note here in passing that there is, at this particular juncture, already a development of the rivalry, the war that I've spoken about on other broadcasts that is still going on between the military and civilian intelligence agencies. And just as there was rivalry and some conflict between the Canaris group and the Seekerites-Deans and later the Canaris and Galen people, so too there are conflicts within our own intelligence system. It's one of the reasons why when I refer to U.S. intelligence trafficking in drugs or supporting terrorism, I say elements of U.S. intelligence, because there are other elements that oppose that kind of thing. It's very important in analyzing the U.S. intelligence apparatus or military or intelligence or political organizations of this or other countries to recognize that very seldom are they monolithic, although often they will unify from a functional standpoint. We're going to skip down a little bit and resume with Oglesby's article. After Galen surrendered to the United States,